Okay, well, last Sunday we started a new series, and that would be Paul's letter to Titus. Very good. Your homework was to read through that short letter twice, which was not very demanding because it's just three chapters. So how many were faithful to do that? All right. Some of you. Many of you weren't. Let's do better next week. All right. Well, before we tackle the actual verse-by-verse part of our study, we, of course, need to spend some time on the background to the letter. Why was it written? When? What were the issues being addressed? What was the occasion that prompted Paul to write it and so forth? All of which, of course, are critical to following the author's train of thought. And, you know, generally speaking, going over background material of any book of the Bible is not the sort of thing that makes for a five-star sermon. Just admit that. Last Sunday, a number of people looked like they had a hard time staying engaged. And this is why, quite frankly, many pastors just skip over those sorts of things because, or they might just spend 5 or 10 minutes on them. It is, after all, as we learn in church growth seminars, it is a sin to do what? To bore people. We just don't want to do that. And the who, what, when, where, and why of a book can, quite frankly, be a little bit on the dry side. So to help with this, I decided to use a little bit of the quiz format. I think it's a somewhat more engaging than the standard lecture, hopefully. The challenge at this point for all of us, of course, is appreciating why any of this background material is even relevant. What difference does it really make in the long run? I'm sure that question comes up in your mind at certain points. And admittedly, I'll just say that some of it isn't all that relevant. It is provided just to help fill in the picture. But some of it is relevant, as you will see once we start in on our study of the actual text itself. And in fact, I'll actually have an example of that at the end of today's message. But in order to act biblically, we have to think biblically. And in order to think biblically, we have to understand what the Bible says. And to understand what the Bible says, we have to comprehend the context in which the various books were written. So with that little pep talk out of the way, let's get started. And the best place to begin is with a little bit of review from last week, because today we're going to build on the material that we talked about then. Titus is very similar to what other book of the Bible? Who wants to tell me that?
New Testament.
Which book in the New Testament? First Timothy. All right, very good. Actually, sometimes Titus is referred to as a miniature First Timothy, and it explains why it's often overlooked. We talked about that as well. It's generally just lumped together with First Timothy. Where was Titus when Paul wrote him this letter? The answer is in the letter itself. You all know this when you'll hear it. Crete, okay. Crete is an island in the Mediterranean Sea. There we have it. And it's about 130 miles across. Give us a little bit of a close up there. All right, does this letter identify its author? Some books of the Bible do, some books don't. Did this one identify its author? It did, all right. And who would that author be that's identified? Paul, okay. I already mentioned that this morning. So, and regarding that claim, Paul's authorship, this is, you got four choices here. It's not disputed by any serious scholar. It is not shared by everyone, but it is the majority opinion. It's pretty much split down the middle, half and half. It is the minority opinion. Should remember this from last week. What do you say? Okay, it is the minority opinion. Most scholars believe that the letter was written well after Paul's death by someone using Paul's name. And they have the same opinion about 1 and 2 Timothy as well. And this is indeed the most controversial part of the letter. And so we'll have to take some time to address it. We'll get into that just a little bit today, but I'll save most of that discussion for an upcoming Sunday. And until we get there, we will work off the assumption that Paul is the author, which has been the traditional view through the centuries. All right, number 5, why did Paul write this letter? Well, it is basically, just always bring this to mind, it's basically a follow-up letter. Paul had left Titus on Crete to take care of some unfinished business there, including that of appointing elders in the various churches that had just been planted. And this lack of leadership and organization there had allowed some less than orthodox teachers to advance some troublesome doctrines, doctrines that would tangle up the new believers with matters of Jewish myths and Jewish genealogies and so on. There are other reasons for the letter as well, which we'll get into, but essentially think of this as a follow-up letter. All right, number six, what was Titus's role at Crete? We spent some time on this and why it's important to know what his role was. Was he a pastor? Was he an elder? Was he a deacon? Was he a traveling evangelist? None of the above. What was he? Most people think that he was a what? Pastor, but the closer you look at the circumstances of the letter, the clearer it becomes that he wasn't serving Crete as a pastor in particular. For one, this is a temporary assignment. Secondly, as we survey the rest of the New Testament looking for the kinds of jobs that Paul had given Titus, we see that they don't really fit that role, that of a pastor. Rather, he is more or less like Paul's right-hand man, his assistant, filling in whatever needed to be done. Sometimes Titus served as kind of a troubleshooter. In regards to his assignment at Crete, it is best that we think of him as Paul's delegate. He's there on Paul's behalf as his representative. And therefore, he was to be regarded as having apostolic authority in the carrying out of his assignment. And even though many of Titus's responsibilities would be similar to that of what we think of as a modern-day pastor, we must be careful that we don't equate the two. And this is a common thing that people do, and you'll go down the wrong track if you do that. Modern-day pastors have not been deputized by an apostle like Titus or Timothy. Also, the assignment that Titus was given is not the same either, at least on all points. All right, number seven, where was Paul when he wrote the letter to Titus? We can't say for sure, but at the end of the letter, Paul tells Titus that once Artemis and Tychicus come to take over for him, he is to meet him at Nicopolis. And so he's either riding from there or he is on his way there. Now, this may seem like kind of a superfluous thing to mention, but it is actually a factor when trying to harmonize this letter with the events recorded in the book of Acts, which we will talk more about this morning. So here is Crete and Nicopolis there on the western side of Greece. And Nicopolis itself is off the beaten path. And the name of the city, we didn't talk about this last week, but the name means City of Victory, for it is where Caesar Augustus defeated Cleopatra. All right, let's move on to other material we have not yet covered. And we'll start with kind of a softball question here. Paul's letter to Titus is considered a prison epistle, a pastoral epistle, both or neither. What do you say? Okay, it's considered a pastoral epistle, though that title is a bit misleading. Again, as mentioned, Titus is not exactly the pastor of the churches in Crete, though he certainly fulfilled many responsibilities that we normally think of along those lines. There are three such epistles, pastoral epistles. What are they? Titus along with 1st and 2nd Timothy, all right? But in this series, we'll continue to use that traditional term, but we do kind of need to keep that distinction. Titus is not a prison epistle because prison epistles were written in prison, all right? So Paul wasn't in prison when he wrote this. All right, number nine. Most likely, this letter was intended to be a private letter to Titus, not to be shared. A semi-private letter to Titus to be shared only with his closest co-workers. An open letter to Titus to be shared with the churches at Crete, with everyone, or none of the above. Someone raise their hand. What do you think? What do you think, Tina? Which one?
B,
all right. Anybody want to say something else? C? How many think C? All right. It's a good guess, but it's actually C. Even though Titus is the one named as the intended recipient, we should realize that a lot of what is conveyed to him is intended for the churches in which he is being directed to minister. And so part of the purpose of this letter is actually that of letting everyone know that Titus has been authorized by Paul to carry out these particular duties in the event that his authority might be challenged, which is something that was anticipated. Thus, the words at the end of chapter 2, let no one despise you. That's really said for the benefit of those troublesome teachers who were advancing Jewish practices. And we would expect that this letter was to be read, to the whole assembly when they met together for teaching and worship. And this would have been true of 1st and 2nd Timothy as well. All right, number 10. From the New Testament, we know that Titus and Timothy were cousins, brothers, that they grew up together in the same town, that they converted to Christ at the same time, that they were nothing more than co-workers. Somebody, anybody, from the New Testament, what would we know? What would you guess? Jan, you're thinking? Take a guess. Take a stab at it. All right, good guess. Actually, all that we know from the New Testament is that both were co-workers of Paul. They may have been more than that, but if so, the New Testament doesn't say. We can assume that they knew each other, that they spent time together, most likely in their comings and goings and dealings with Paul. It is unlikely that they were relatives. Titus was a Gentile. It appears that Timothy had a Jewish mom who had converted to Christianity. Titus himself is actually a bit of a mystery, so let's talk about him since he is the subject of this letter, and that's kind of the reason for the questions, to give us a springboard to talk about Titus himself. Scholars have wondered why he's not mentioned in the book of Acts. He's not mentioned anywhere in that whole book. One explanation for this is that he may have been Luke's relative, perhaps even his brother. It's kind of the tradition of the day that you don't mention close family members like that. We can't say, it's just a guess. We know, however, from Paul's letter to Galatians that Titus went with both Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem. This is sort of an interesting thing here that helps fill in the picture. And there he received the approval of the 12, the apostles there, to remain uncircumcised. Remember that? It's talked about in Book of Galatians, and this lack of circumcision was a key factor in securing the right of the Gentiles to enjoy a gospel free from obeying the rituals of the Mosaic law. So Titus was like the test case and all that. So in regard, now think back to the setting at Crete, in regard to refuting those unorthodox teachers in Crete who were weighing the new believers down with Jewish practices, well, I mean, Titus would have been the perfect man for the job because he would have been well-versed in all of those arguments. And there's also this, and actually John talked a little bit about it this morning here. Toward the end of his third missionary journey, Paul had sent Titus from Ephesus to Corinth to deliver what is commonly referred to as the sorrowful letter or the severe letter. And we don't have a copy of that letter. It's been lost, but we can get a gist of its message from 2 Corinthians. It appears that in that lost letter, that severe letter, that Paul rebukes the church at Corinth, and in particular a ringleader of a group of super apostles who were challenging Paul's apostleship and therefore not following Paul's instructions. And this, of course, would have been an awkward job for Titus to deliver something like that, because you know it's going to be a pretty contentious sort of thing. And in the same letter, Paul tells them to set aside money for the believers in Jerusalem who are suffering from a famine. So again, like we mentioned last week, you go there, you know, Paul telling Titus, here, take this letter, go rebuke them, and then ask for money, and then come back. I mean, that'd be quite an assignment. Later, Paul sends Titus back to Corinth again to complete the collection of the Jerusalem Relief Fund and to deliver another letter, the one we know as 2 Corinthians. We can't say for sure what eventually happened to Titus. According to the 4th century church historian Eusebius, he eventually returned to Crete, and there he died of old age. All right, now we need to get into a big one, and this has to do with chronology. When did Paul go to Crete? The question touches on a lot of different issues here, so let's see how we can navigate through this. Acts records Paul's mission trip to Crete as part of his first missionary journey, his second missionary journey, his third missionary journey. Well, the trip is not mentioned. Who wants to take a stab at it? What do you think? Where's John Nelson? I was going to ask him. He left? Brink. He's teaching Brink. Well, go get him. What do you think? Do you remember what all happened in all the missionary journeys? If you don't, that's okay. I can't keep them straight either. All right. Well, there was actually a stopover at Crete while he was on his way to Rome, but he was in the custody of Roman soldiers at that time, so that was not a missions trip. Not even sure if they even stopped at the island. Actually, it's not mentioned. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment. Do you think that that might not be a big deal in some way? The fact that this trip is not mentioned in the book of Acts. Do you think that scholars would not be all over something like that? Well, they certainly are. Again, the working theory here is that Paul went to Crete on a missionary journey and planted churches there. However, Luke only tells us of three mission trips, none of which mention Paul going to Crete. It is, however, possible that the churches on that island had been planted by someone else, and Paul, eager to see those churches mature, took it upon himself to send Titus there as his representative to go and help move things along, straighten some things out, appoint elders, and so on. And while this is a possibility, it is not viewed as a likely scenario, one that nobody really takes seriously. But even if that were the case, we have no mention in the book of Acts of Paul ever going to Nicopolis. And that's why I mentioned that city earlier, which, as we know from the letters, where Paul was going to meet Titus. In fact, not only can we not reconstruct from the book of Acts Paul's trip to Crete and to Nicopolis, but events mentioned in 1st or 2nd Timothy as well. They don't fit. So what do we do with that? This is actually, you know, the big deal. Well, those who reject Paul's authorship, as we will talk about in a couple weeks, they have an answer for that. The letter is it's a fake. It's a fake. It can't be true because it doesn't fit anything. They claim that Paul remains in prison at the end of the book of Acts until he is martyred under Nero, and that someone else, pretending to be Paul, 100 years later perhaps, wrote not only Titus but also 1st and 2nd Timothy. All three letters then are actually fictional. They're frauds. The writer used Paul's name to ensure their acceptance by the Christians. So this theory, while trying to solve certain problems, actually ends up creating some of its own, which we'll see when we tackle the authorship question in a couple weeks. Another theory asserts that the situation referred to in Titus and in these two letters to Timothy actually happened after the book of Acts, after chapter 28, which is the last chapter. And this is commonly referred to as the second imprisonment theory. And actually, this is the traditional view and has been the most commonly accepted position through the centuries. And so at the end of Acts, in chapter 28, we have Paul incarcerated by the Romans, if you're familiar with how Acts ends. And this appears to be a house arrest situation there. He's granted a great deal of freedom. He's living in his own rented home, but yet he is a prisoner waiting for his day of court. And it is believed then that after Acts 28, that Paul was released from this first imprisonment at some point. And if so, this would have created additional opportunities for travel and ministry that are spoken of in the letters to Timothy and Titus, but of course would not be mentioned in the book of Acts. So to put it on a timeline, it would look something like this. Around 62, we have Paul imprisoned in Rome, which is spoken of in Acts 28. After that, between 62 and 64, he's released from prison. He resumes his ministry work, and that would have included his ministry to Crete during that period. He writes 1 Timothy. He writes Titus. That explains why both letters are very similar. And then 64 to 67, he's imprisoned again. And there in jail, he writes 2 Timothy and anticipates his death and is indeed martyred in Rome. All right, now, there's nothing in Scripture that would rule out this scenario. We would also have to admit that there's also no hard evidence to support it. The main complaint against it is both the unlikelihood that Paul would have ever been released from prison. Scholars raise their eyebrows about that. And that something like that, his release, would not be mentioned elsewhere or anywhere in the New Testament. That's a bit of a troublesome point as well. But again, the whole scenario here itself is actually a doable one, and it is the most common working theory among those who believe that the letters are authentic. An alternative approach is to place the situation of Titus within the framework of Acts. There are a handful of such reconstructions, and they all differ in the details. Essentially, scholars are looking for gaps of time in Acts that could account for a trip to Crete. And a popular one here would look like this. It would place the situation at Crete during Paul's third missionary journey. I won't map it out in detail because it's kind of hard to follow, but basically it is suggested that this missionary journey had two stages to it, with a 1-year gap in between those two stages. Luke doesn't report any travels during that gap, but some things could be filled in with information provided from other New Testament sources. In this scenario, one can't say for sure whether Paul actually went to Crete or not. It may very well be that during that one-year gap, he simply sent Titus there and then expected to meet up with them at Nicopolis. The main thing here is that this is a possibility. And as you will see, the big advantage here is that we would only have one Roman imprisonment, the one spoken of in chapter 28. So we would not be left speculating about why Paul was released and why that's not mentioned. There are other reconstructions as well. Suffice it to say that each theory has its own set of strengths and weaknesses. So when it comes down to it, you basically are left with one of three options. The situation described in Titus is either fictional, or it happened after the book of Acts, or it happened during a gap in one of Paul's missionary journeys that is simply not reported on. In this study, I will be favoring the traditional view, commonly referred to as the second imprisonment theory. What happened to my slide? There it is. Did I miss the one slide? Did everyone see that slide? Okay. I think I just jumped too fast. So this, what you're seeing here is the one that I will be, I'll be favoring, that Paul was released after Acts 28, continued missionary travels, and that the situations described in the pastoral epistles occurred then. And again, this view enjoys support from those scholars who accept Paul as the legitimate author. All right, any questions on that? Good, let's move on. All right, let's now look at something more related to the content of the letter. The tone of Paul's letter to Titus is harsh. Paul scolds him for not dealing with false teachers. Whoops, what happened? Oh, did everyone see that slide? Yeah, okay. Now I'm ready for this one.
Yeah. This doesn't happen in those churches you visit.
Yeah, it never happens in those churches because I don't know. They have wizardry going on there that I don't have access to or something. I don't know. All right. The tone of Paul's letter to Titus is harsh. Paul scolds him for not dealing with false teachers and sin in the church. He follows up with this letter and is very upset. It's uplifting. Paul rejoices that the Cretan Christians are doing so well. It's discouraging. Paul wonders why the sacrifice is made, wonders if the sacrifices made for the missionary efforts in Crete are really worth it, given all the setbacks. Or D, somewhat matter of fact, it's not especially urgent and less forceful than the two letters to Timothy. What do you think? How many think A, B, C, D? Everyone was saying D? Boy, you guys are good. You're catching on. This is great. All right, Paul just doesn't seem to be all that troubled or worked up in this letter. The letter to Galatians, for instance, you remember that letter? It is a thunderstorm. Paul is very harsh in that letter. The letter to the Philippians, on the other hand, is like a cheerful, sunny day. He's very upbeat and positive. Titus is more of a down-to-business kind of letter. Little indication of much emotion one way or the other. It's pretty low-key for the most part. For instance, Paul doesn't exhort Titus. Let me say that again. For instance, while Paul does exhort Titus to address the problem of false teachers who are causing problems, the letter as a whole is not dominated by that issue. He mentions it at the beginning and then he moves on. And when you read Titus next to its twin, 1 Timothy, it does. It just tends to be a little bit more flat, if I can put it that way. In 1 Timothy, there's this marching orders kind of tone, you know, to fight the good fight and guard the deposit and so on. And we just don't have that kind of charged up rallying cry language in this letter. One reason for this is that the churches on Crete are newer and the problems there are not really all that bad. There are threats to the gospel, but it's nothing that can't be handled, nothing that Titus can't take care of. Paul seems to be more concerned about these younger believers being able to break away from the corrupt and depraved culture of Crete itself. In fact, the dominant theme of the letter is actually that of good works. Good works for two reasons. First, this is what Christians do. This is the fruit of our salvation. And secondly, this is how we make the gospel attractive to the pagans. So no scolding, no correcting of beliefs or practices, no sense of urgency. It's pretty much straightforward, let's take care of business kind of letter. All right, number 13. This now leads to this question, a big one. What exactly prompted Paul to write the letter? We've touched on this already, but it might be good to actually dispel it out. And for this, I'm going to refer to the New Testament scholar Gordon Fee. I think he says this really quite well. He captures it with these words. Why then did Paul write such a letter and when? Since it displays a more preventative, less urgent appearance than 1 Timothy, the epistle to Titus was probably written later. Paul had left Titus in Crete to finish setting the churches in order after he and Timothy had gone to Ephesus and found the church there in such disarray. Paul left Timothy there to restore order. In Macedonia, he wrote back to Ephesus to give Timothy authority for his task there. At the same time, he reflected on some similar opposition encountered in Crete while he had been there, so he also wrote to Titus, again to give him authority against those false teachers. But because the situation there lacked the urgency of Ephesus, he encourages Titus to help the people toward exemplary Christian behavior for the sake of the world. All right, let me work in one more. I've actually got a few more, but I'll cut it after the next one, and then I'll lead us for our next, it'll set things up for the next time. The saying, from a Cretan point of view, met from a hopeful, positive perspective, from a hopeless, negative perspective, to be deceptive, to be jovial, lighthearted, even silly. What do you think? C. How many think C? To be deceptive. All right, good. There is actually historical evidence indicating that Cretans regarded lying as socially acceptable. In fact, there was a Greek word coined for deception. I'm going to try to pronounce it, even though I was in the Greek class. I don't know if I can pronounce this right, so go ahead and correct me. I'll take the scolding. Kritizo. Does that sound right?
Sure.
Kritizo. All right. Which is taken from where? What does it sound like? Kritizo sounds like, yeah, it's taken from the name of the island, and it actually means to lie. Or to play the Cretan. They even lied about religious matters, which we'll talk about more the next time. So let me skip ahead now and all this other stuff I was so eager to talk about. I need to ring the Sunday school bell. Next week, we will have the Lord's Supper service, so we won't be talking about Titus then. The week after that, we have Body Life Sunday. So we will resume our study here the following week, July 13th. And we have just a few more background questions, and then we do want to tackle this whole problem of, not problem, the controversy of Paul's authorship. There's a lot of factors involved in that. As I mentioned last week, the arguments against Paul's authorship are not off-the-wall crazy stuff. They're serious points that need serious response to. So we'll work through that. And again, your homework here, if I could just encourage you to read through it again twice a week, each week here. And each time you read it, it'd be good if you could just read it in one sitting from beginning to end. Ignore the chapter divisions. It's easy enough to do. It's a short book. And as you read it, you know, try to bring to mind at least some of the background material that we've discussed so far, even though we have more to get into. All right, so let's go ahead and have the musicians come at this time and the singers, and we'll let the children come in.